Don't she rock?
Dedicates itself to the critical and comical dissection of every movie in Ian Fleming's 007 film series, one episode a month for 24 consecutive months, where we will be discussing one James Bond film at a time, in chronological order, leading up to the eventual release of the 25th entry in the James Bond series, which as of this date is still unnamed. My name is Colin Shaw, and today's episode will be focused on The Spy Who Loved Me, the 10th entry into the 007 series, and the third outing of Sir Roger Moore as James Bond. I am, of course, joined by my two Bond-obsessed co-hosts, Harris McCabe.
What's up?
And Matt McGregor.
What's cooking, good looking?
Let's get started. What did you guys think of this movie? What did you guys think of that intro?
That was nice. That was some great reading.
Yeah.
I have to say, Matt has done a great job in the past, but you can also read, apparently.
You were great at reading.
They did tests in school to see if I knew the letters and the way that and the syllables and stuff like that.
A little shout out to the Texas public school system?
Yes, Texas public school system coming through.
Guys, I think I want to shout out that this podcast is moving up and up, and technologically, we were able to hear the song for the first time, and that song was, of course, created by the one, the only, C-Rock. How you doing over there?
What up?
Hey, did you watch this movie?
Hell no.
Damn it. He didn't watch it. I thought he might say something different.
One day.
Time.
One day.
Yeah,
one day C-Rock will watch one of these movies.
Let's go. Let's dive in.
Let's dive
in. Have we ever blasted your SoundCloud? Do you want to shout that out?
Sure.
What is it? SoundCloud?
C-D-O-T-R-O-C-C.
You so actually have to write D-O-T?
Yeah, because you can't put a dot in a URL.
Oh, that's good to know.
C-Rock, just like C-Dot Rock.
C-Dot Rock.
Oh, it's URL? I always thought it was a guy named Earl.
Earl.
Oh, God.
Sorry.
Dad jokes already? It's early in the podcast.
What did I do?
Another great beat as usual. Let's talk about this movie, because there's some interesting, just in general, this is 1977 now.
Yes.
A great year.
Yeah, a great year. None of us were alive, I don't think, at that point.
No.
Not even me.
Not even a twinkle in your daddy's eye.
I was probably a twinkle in my daddy's eye. Interesting changes in the franchise, though, because this is the first movie that isn't produced by Harry Saltzman. He was bought out. He sold his stake because of...
For $20 million, right?
Yeah, for unrelated financial problems. He was making some other bad investments. But so now this is Cubby Broccoli is the sole producer.
Mm-hmm. I was about to ask you if we were comfortable calling him Cubby. Because as we've all read, that is like his nickname in real life. But I'm sure we all assumed that people who knew him called him that.
Only his closest confidants, which I feel like at this point with this podcast, we are.
Yeah. In the first few episodes, it's Albert, but now I feel like we've earned Cubby.
And hopefully by the end we'll be calling Cubs.
Cubs. Yes.
With a Z.
Yeah. So for a little perspective, Man with the Golden Gun was our last Bond film. That underperformed, and there were some, for the first time, there was some doubts about the franchise. It was sort of the first disappointment they'd had. And instead of getting tight, Cubby doubled down.
Yeah, he spent the most he spent.
Yep, increased the budget.
Which was what?
It was $14 million budget on this. Yep. It paid
Which
off.
In today's money, that's like $1 billion.
It's a lot of money. So $14 million was quite a bit back then, and they grossed $185 million at the box office. So it was a bet that paid off for him. Also, a distinguishing feature of this one is that it was not based on an original Ian Fleming story. They took the title from a novel, which, does anybody know anything about the novel and why they didn't use it?
I heard that Ian Fleming, hated it. He thought
he wouldn't print it in paperback because he didn't want it to
sell.
It
was only after he died that it became popular.
One of the reasons he didn't like it was because it was unique in that it was told from the perspective of a Bond girl, and Bond himself doesn't make an appearance until chapter, I think, 10 of a 14-chapter novel. Yeah. So he basically comes in the final third and is a minor character. So Ian Fleming said, yes, go ahead and use the title, The Spy Who Loved Me. It's a great fucking title. But he said you can't use any elements of the plot. They did sort of cheat because two of the henchmen in the book were similar to the two henchmen that we have in this film.
In appearance only, right?
But everything else was different. So they basically invented the story from scratch.
This is the first time they did that.
Yeah, and they went through, I think there was like six or seven writers that they were trying to, that at various times worked on this project before Richard Maybaum, who had done, I think at this point, written seven or eight Bond movies, adapted them. He ended up being the final writer with Christopher Wood doing a pass as well.
Yeah, who's and they got novelist. They got all the like good people that they worked with before. They got a director who had done
You Only Live Twice.
They got a cinematographer who had done some cool stuff.
Yep, they DP was Claude Renoir, who was the grandson of Pierre-Auguste Renoir, the artist, and the nephew of Jean Renoir, the famous filmmaker. Mm-hmm. They got Ken Adams back doing production design.
Ken Adams
killing it again. The production design is insane in this. And Louis Gilbert was a director who did You Only Live Twice and ended up doing this movie, and then I think he did Moonraker as well. They were originally going to bring Guy Hamilton back, who had done several Bond movies. Yeah. He left this to go do Superman, and then that didn't work out either. And he got replaced by Richard Donner. Mm-hmm. So So he went from having two great movies going on in 1977 to ending up with
nothing.
None.
Yeah,
I'm blanking. I can't think of his name. The director of American Werewolf. Oh, John Landis.
Yeah, John Landis.
He
did
a pass on this script. Yeah.
So everyone worked on this script at one point.
Do you ever just kind of like take like a little stance and kind of like put your hands on your hips and lift your chest up a little bit and just like be like, da, 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 da.
That's actually how I pee.
Yeah. Oh, I also, that's good. I also,
song every time. I've been in a public restroom with you and it's really weird.
If there's somebody else around, I just tend to hum it quietly. But
just screaming.
I have a good story actually. When I was in fourth grade, they made us watch the movie Free Willy.
Uh-huh.
It was like a, you know, movie day or whatever. Yeah. The teacher was hungover or whatever. And do you remember the song that plays in the credits at the end of that movie? It's a Michael Jackson song. So I had to use the restroom, and I went in there, and I was at the urinal, and I started like singing that song to myself, only for a friend of mine to come out of the stall, and like I didn't know he was there.
That is totally the Free Willy song, though.
It was really embarrassing.
It works at so many levels.
Freeing Willy.
I freed my Willy. Exactly.
Yeah.
Willy.
Yeah. The other interesting thing about this whole story and the movie is that they were also involved in a lawsuit at this time with another group of people who owned one single James Bond movie. What was the one? They ended up remaking it as Never Say Never Again with Sean Connery,
which is a remake of Thunderball.
Title. Yeah. What was the? Was it Thunderball?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a remake of Thunderball.
It was a
remake.
That's
of Thunderball.
That's the one with the flying saucer boat.
Right.
Yeah.
So they there was somebody else who had part ownership of that story, and because Spectre and Blofeld were in that story, that who owned Blofeld as a character was up for dispute. And so originally Blofeld was the scripted villain of this, and then when they realized it was going to be a lot of trouble, legal trouble, and they weren't sure where it stood, they just said, just make it somebody else. So the villain we get in here is Carl Stromberg,
who is
basically a Blofeld stand-in.
Yeah, it would have made more sense with Blofeld, because like, why? Stromberg has like a lot of employees. But, like, what is their motivation?
Yeah.
Like, what are they doing? Even there's a part when, it's too far down the line, but, like, if you think about all his characters, but Jaws doesn't talk, so, I mean, you're not going to get a lot of what his motivation really is besides that he's paid to kill, which, you know, that rounds out his character functionally. But the other people that work for Stromberg, it's like, what do they see their future being here?
You know, Aquaman. Better to be on the Aquafort than in the nuclear apocalypse.
Maybe they were just like, he has a really great fish logo, you know? Like, I'm really drawn to the logo.
I really like the logo, actually. Reminded me of kind of like a chessboard almost. Yeah. Doesn't it have that like black and white?
Yeah, it's like a black and white fish scales. The fish is always pointing up.
And it's circular.
Like maybe that was part of the brainwashing.
It's circular.
You come
just
to Strongbug like Industries. Note that the fish logo is always looking up.
Is also circular, so it was like an easy swap there. Just like, get rid of the Spectre logos, turn them into Stromberg logos, and we're off to the races.
But Stromberg could have been like a number in the Spectre.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. But using Spectre at all would have opened them up to this lawsuit, and they weren't sure how they were going to fare, so they just basically ditched it.
I kind of like that they ditched it, you know, changed things up a little bit. Or, yeah, they couldn't even mention Spectre, I guess, right?
They don't go back to Spectre until, like, Daniel Craig,
until
right?
Until Spectre, yeah.
I believe that the property was still sort of in dispute until then.
Never Say Never Again.
What made the dispute end? Did someone pass away or something?
I don't know. I think we'll probably get to that in a later Bond film because I believe that was right up until the Daniel Craig era. I think they still weren't sure if they could use him. So
I have some morbid trivia about this movie that I thought was interesting. This was
that ought to lighten things
this
up.
This was the last movie that Elvis Presley saw.
Saw that. Yeah,
not a bad one. This was also
like 4 or 6 days later.
This is,
yep.
Also, the last movie that. Who are the Lyle and what's his
the Menendez
brothers' parents saw?
They were watching.
Really?
This.
They didn't see the entire thing because they got interrupted by shotguns. But
they were on their couch watching this movie on a VCR, and their children came in and blew them away.
So listen to the rest of the podcast to find out if we think it's worth it.
Find out if we make it to the end of this one.
Great, we've added some tension here.
All right, let's talk about the gun barrel sequence.
It's a new version.
Oh, yeah, it's the new version. This is the Bell Bottoms one. This is what I've been waiting for.
Yep.
That tuxedo with Bell Bottoms.
It's the first time Bond's in a tuxedo.
Yep. Yeah.
This is, I think we had a previous, Connery, the original Connery movies were done by his stunt double, and then they changed it to the Connery version that we saw for a few of them. Because they had an aspect ratio change in the film stock they were using. This is again they had one that they had done for Roger Moore 2 movies in a row, and they re-recorded it this time for the same reason. They had changed film stock, and this is a version of him in a tux with some real flared pants there.
So this one is wider, right?
Yeah. So just to explain aspect ratio, if people don't know. It, like, so
Google.
The previous movies, like movies in the past, were more square shaped because TVs were that size, or not even because of TVs. It was just like the film standard.
Well, I mean, like it would have been projected onto a screen, so it's like whatever. It's based on what you're shooting it on.
During that time, we're changing, and you know, movies began getting wider and wider. Like Lawrence of Arabia is like in CinemaScope.
Yeah.
And, so they needed to change that opening because it was done the old flat way. There's flat and scope. So they needed to redo it. One thing I'm excited about is that we don't really have to talk about this for the next 4 movies because they reused this one, I think, through to the end of his Bond.
Yeah, they didn't
Bond
change
dump.
It again.
Yep. Yeah.
Cold open?
Yeah. This is one of the best cold opens, I think.
Oh, the parachute?
I mean, it's okay, we'll get to that. It starts... With what?
XXX.
The submarine, right?
Oh, yeah. It starts off with the submarines.
Probably the lamest part.
In this
So it shows the submarine getting swallowed up, but we don't see that. We just see the guy look through the periscope, and he's like, my God.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. That's pretty cool.
Then we find out that the there's Russians and the U.S. have both lost
a sub. Oh, because it's a Russian sub that's lost, right? Yeah, so then
Russians and the Brits.
And the Brits.
The Brits are the ones
US
that get
the ones
eaten
get,
in the beginning.
Yeah,
or we don't know what happens to them.
Right.
Because that's why he says, oh, my God, in English. Because they're talking in English to each other in that
part. Yeah.
Right.
But
yeah.
we learn that both the Russians and the British are both, they're summoning their secret agents.
They've lost submarines.
And we see this very suave, Bond-looking Russian spy-type guy
in bed
with a beautiful woman, and he gets the call. On the radio, they get the call on the bed, XXX, come in, your country needs you, blah, blah, blah. And he rolls over like he's going to answer it. And then the woman leans over him and responds. And we find out that XXX, the super secret agent from Russia, is actually a beautiful woman played by Barbara Bach.
Yes.
Right. Then we see the guy. He's like, oh, I got a mission of my own.
Yep.
And I'm going to Austria.
Yes, that's right.
And then we
cut to
a little log cabin on a mountain
in
Austria.
Before that, we cut to M and Moneypenny, and he says,
"Oh God,
Moneypenny, where's 007? And she says, he's on a mission, sir. And he says, well, tell him to pull out immediately.
Guess what kind of mission Bond was on?
Yeah, that's one of the some of the jokes to me in this one don't land, and some of them are kind of weird. Like, what about when Jaws kills the guy and he's next to a phone booth that has an out of order sign on it? So he takes the out of order sign off the phone booth and puts it on the dead guy.
Bond just puts it, yeah, like little.
Is
soon.
That even funny?
Yeah,
yeah. I think this movie. I mean, we'll get to it at the end, but right, yeah. Really, this is the culmination of, like, for me, Roger Moore. Like, this is, you know, he had the two movies to kind of practice. He got to this movie, and it's great.
This is peak Moore.
And there's, yeah. It's peak Moore, but they pepper it with these jokes. They try to make it funny, and then whoever saw this movie, you know, or, like, the makers of this movie, they said, the best part are these cheesy jokes. We need more of these.
Right.
And then going forward, it's just the downward slope of cheesiness. Yeah. So we'll get to that.
But I think some of the jokes land better when they start, like, doing more of them. The jokes in this one, like,
they're few and far between.
It's like they're kind of trying too hard when they have them. And,
yeah.
And it's, yeah, they're not really.
But the this joke
the
was
pulling
good.
Out joke was yeah. good, especially because it's also just great advice for him in general.
That's, right, yeah. And know. It's not Bond saying it. And yeah. So that's, like, kind of. But anyways, then we cut to him,
slam
and he
cut,
is, of
yeah.
course, in bed with a woman in the little log cabin, and then he gets a call on some...
No, his watch, the
yeah,
little printout.
It's the it's like
a label maker.
Yeah. His watch has a label maker in it,
it's like
which
Bond.
Must have been incredibly impressive in 1977.
It's so bad now.
So now he's got to rush off to save the world, and the woman that he's with immediately picks up her radio and says, oh, he's just left, and they're like, we're ready for him.
She
and
says,
it's all these.
But James, I need you. And he turns around and says, so does England.
Of course.
So does England.
So bad.
So he hops on his skis because he's got to ski away from this place. Why was he there ever, anyways? But
right. He's in a bright yellow.
Yeah, he's in bright yellow. He has a really big backpack on for some reason. It must have all his stuff in it or something.
His spy stuff.
So then, like, about 10 Russian ski guys start chasing him. We get a ski chase.
It's a pretty good ski chase, too.
I would say it's, like, shot really well. The only part that bugs me, and it's probably the same thing that bug you guys, are the close-ups of him, where you could tell it's, like, the poor man's process thing going on.
But it was better than, to compare it to On Her Majesty's Secret Service, which also had a great ski scene, but the poor man's process was used extensively in that one. This time, they don't use it that much. They mostly use stunt performers from a distance, and it works a lot better. They only have a couple of close-ups. Most of it is shot at a distance. They're skiing backwards.
Yeah,
he turns his ski pole into a gun and shoots, apparently, a flaming bullet into the guy's chest because it lights on fire in the guy's chest.
Damn, doesn't that death come back later?
Yes.
That is the guy.
Yeah,
and
the guy.
It also, there's like a, they're playing the Bond theme, but there's like a little bit of a disco.
A 70s.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
and it's got hella cowbell in it. Like,
yeah,
the cowbell is just going. It's like Blue Oyster Cult level, except there's more pauses, but it's like that level of cowbell.
Yeah. And there's also a really stupid whooshing sound effect when some guy does a jumping ski flip that's like corny, you know, like the slide whistle on the car.
Yeah.
But anyways, the stunt is great, and they like ski through these little like snow tunnels, and it's pretty badass.
Yeah, and I've said it before, and I'll say it again. When you're talking about James Bond, this motherfucker can ski.
He can fucking ski.
And at the end of this incredible ski run, he reaches the point where there's nowhere to go. These Russian guys are in hot pursuit, and he skis off a goddamn cliff into just thin air, thousands of feet dropping. What's going to happen? His skis fall off. You're like, oh my God, James Bond is screwed. And then suddenly that giant backpack opens up. A parachute deploys, and not just any parachute. It's got the Union Jack on it, and there's a little bit of a music cue.
One of the trivia things was when they screened it, I think, for the royal family or whatever, the prince, like, stood up when the
got Union Jack stand up to salute the Union Jack. They were saying there was, like, tears in people's eyes when they saw that. It was, like, the best stunt. When they came up with that idea, they were
they
like, oh, my God.
They paid that guy $30,000 just to do that.
Which in
just
today's money is, like, $1 billion.
Yeah,
but he's free-falling.
Matt is our official money currency translator.
Guys, I'm no mathematician, but pretty sure
but it's
free-falling for like 10 seconds.
Oh, it's a long...
The
and
skis are flying everywhere. The ski could have punctured the thing.
I think I can't remember. I think they said that he skied off a cliff in... Is it somewhere in Vancouver?
Yeah, it's in Canada.
But it's basically a base jump ski off the edge of a cliff. and then into and, this parachute thing.
It was
it
so hard
nuts.
To get it. Like they had like four or five cameras, only one camera. Like
even. Oh, I think yeah. I heard they had even more than four, but only one of them actually ended up catching it. Yeah. And luckily, it was a great view of it. So yeah, really one of the best cold opens. Pretty badass. And it was when I saw that parachute open, I realized. This is probably the James Bond movie I watched the most as a kid. Like, just on television, I was like, everything about it was so familiar, and I was like, this is the one of the old Bonds that I remember the most from watching on TV as a kid. And it just kept on happening throughout this movie. I kept being like,
it's all signature Bond stuff.
Yeah.
The only I only wish it was like the parachute backpack wasn't so big. Because it's like, when he first skis out of the door, I'm like, what is in his backpack?
I just assumed it was survival gear.
We're trying to find that 70s music, the 70s Bond theme. Oh, yeah, this is it.
Oh, yeah, Calibur. The little wah, 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 wah.
Oh, yeah.
That's his stuff. Now, picture some hot skiing action, some bullets that explode into flames, weird whooshing sound effects,
monkey jump,
ski jump. Yep. He's skiing forward. He turns around. He's skiing backwards. He looks at the ski pole. There's a little trigger on it. Oh, he points it at a guy. He shoots him. It's a gun ski pole.
I like this. Let's reenact it over with words over the music.
It's pretty great. I'm sure everyone out there is getting a feeling of it.
Right.
And that whole thing leads up into our main titles and theme song.
This is the part. Okay. The rest is all pretty much the same.
All right, we gotta move on.
I mean, can we just leave this?
Just keep going.
Yeah.
A better podcast is just listening to this music for. Just kidding. No, listen to us.
So, anyways, we get the title sequence.
Yeah.
What did we think about this one?
It's Mo Binder again. It's naked women silhouettes. Some suggestion of underwater stuff. I thought there was really some cool. It's pretty much standard James Bond theme. It's, you know, Maurice Binder's been doing these for a long time, yeah. And it's nothing revolutionary, and yet the execution I thought was really great here. And I love the you have male and female secret agents running around, and they do some interesting things with like.
There's one part in particular I like where he's they're holding hands, they're like running away and holding hands, and he turns to shoot, but like you don't just see that, you see it three times because they like stop. And start it like with a
and there's
like a time lapse.
Three
effect.
Different versions of them.
Yeah, and it's like, but they're all like running and holding hands together.
And it's all like subtly different. And then there's another great one where there's three of the female spies like sort of march out to him.
Yeah.
And he shoots them with a gun and they all fall over. Like they do a nice job of being creative with the old gag.
Yeah.
And you have, you know, like a great song going along with it.
You
as well.
Also see a lot of nip in this movie.
Yes.
During that part, you see quite a bit. I forgot to mention in the very beginning of the movie, during the submarine part, a guy's like walking down a hallway, and as the camera backs up, it reveals like posters hanging on the wall. You see boobs. This is a PG movie.
Oh yeah, it is PG.
Matt has a great eye for this kind of stuff, and it's not just because he watches it in freeze frame and frame by frame is the entire thing.
I like doing these segments. This is my segment, the Nip Show. Like, how much nip is in the Bond?
Welcome to the Nip Show.
Oh, do we have Carly Simon playing right now?
What was I going to say?
Continue.
I'll
interject anytime boobs are in the movie.
Speaking of, I just want to go right in. This is the best wardrobe or costumes, I think, in a lot of, it's in the top
for
five.
For who? For everyone?
Everyone across the board. Stromberg's got the same bullshit they always put the villain in.
So nobody does it better.
Nehru jackets.
Yeah, but every single suit Bond has, at least every single tie is great. Almost all the suits are really good.
The girls' outfits are really good too.
Though especially them being in the tuxedo and she's in the evening gown with the little like diamond thing, and they're in that for like three different scenes because
They have a survivalist type,
right?
Yeah.
And those outfits are so good.
Stromberg puts her in a nice dress, too.
My favorite is the hotel receptionist, who has some kind of, like, frills or furls. What's the distinction between a frill and a furl?
I don't know.
I don't know what a furl is.
A
frill frills and a furl unfurls.
But, like, she's just got this, like, shit all over her chest.
Boobs.
Boobs. She's got some big old boobs.
We're going to leave the shit but all it's over like, the chest.
No,
alone.
No, no. I mean, I don't know how to say it. All right,
so what happens next, guys? We're just...
It's
we're
just a really there. Great...
Well, what happens next is we listen to this great Carly Simon song.
Oh, should
song.
We do the...
We're still listening
we
to the song.
We're listening to the song. We haven't even talked about the song. It's one of the great... It's one of the.
It was nominated for an Oscar for Best Song.
This movie was the most Oscar-nominated Bond film...
Until Skyfall.
Until Skyfall.
It was nominated for three things?
Yeah, it was the production design... The soundtrack and the not the soundtrack, the score and the song, but this is one of the greats. It's Marvin Hamlisch wrote it. Carly Simon sings it. She's got a great voice. It's a catchy tune. It's got that, but it's like it's got sneaky hooks too. Because there's a lot of them like Live and Let Die and You Only Live Twice that have like a great noticeable hook. But this one's got a nice that little piano intro and outro that they do. Then it's got the drum beat comes in really hard after the first verse and it's like. Cool there, and then there's even like a change up at the end when like the outro music sort of changes into this like more intense up tempo stuff. It's just a really great catchy song.
Yeah, it's excellent.
I don't know if it's my favorite, but it's like top three I think for me.
Yeah,
it's definitely.
Didn't
there.
They use this song for other companies use this? Like I feel like I heard this growing up for like on a Safeway commercial or something like.
Oh,
that.
Maybe.
Well, and it definitely was one of Carly Simon's. Biggest hit. Just, so she. And
I feel like I've heard other pretty, companies use
this. Is a song
reason.
I would say like one of the few Bond songs that transcends its Bondness.
Yeah. Right.
Like it. Like it was Live a and popular Let Die, song. Sure. Yeah. Live and Let Die too. I would say Skyfall maybe also that was pretty popular on the radio.
Mm-hmm. Which song is that?
Skyfall.
We know what's the artist.
Adele.
Oh, Skyfall. Adele. Yeah. No, I'm just
kidding. Skyfall by Skyfall.
Boobs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Adele. $1 billion. Known for singing well.
Yeah.
I would say.
Yeah, she's all right.
So, Matt, you were talking a little bit about this being peak Connery. I still don't think he's – or peak Moore, sorry. I still don't think he's, like, not totally convincing as a tough guy. But what I do think they figured out was that his strength was a little different, and they wrote the character to be more quippy, way more suave. And they also dropped – I feel like at the beginning they were doing that bourbon and cigars thing to try to differentiate him.
Oh, yeah.
And finally they were just like, you know what? Everyone knows that he's different. He can just be himself and just sort of do his own
thing.
Well,
in this one they acknowledge all the old movies now. They went back – when she knows – when the enemy spy, Triple X, she knows his backstory. She includes the fact that he has sex with a lot of women. But she also includes the fact that she knows he was married once,
mm-hmm.
which they didn't acknowledge – with Roger Moore until now.
Right.
Right.
Remember when we talked about
and
Diamonds
you
Are Forever?
It was more ambiguous than we
yeah,
did.
Yeah, they just left it like
ambiguous.
Maybe it happened, maybe it didn't happen, right?
Right.
But now they're like, okay, well, yeah, we made that movie. We did it.
Right. So up to this point in the canon, they are now acknowledging that all the Sean Connery movies that happened before this. Like it all happened in a row. Like
right.
up to the, and this is the same guy, even though he's played by a different actor. It's the same character.
Right.
That this gets a little vague down the road. We'll get there when they start changing things up, and when enough time passes that it couldn't logically be the same.
I mean, technically, enough time has passed already, as we talked about when we talked about Quarrel.
Yeah.
And,
what it,
and,
what was
and
the
Quarrel
first
Jr.
one? Like 55?
62.
62.
So let's say if he was 30 years old in 1962, what year is it now?
77.
Come on, Matt.
8 plus
math.
7 plus 30 is...
30 plus 17, 45. So he's 47. No, I'm sorry, 62, not 60.
What?
So 45. Yeah, you're right.
Who,
yeah.
Is that still 45?
The important thing is...
So it could be done. He could be a 45-year-old spy.
Yeah, but,
but
Quarrel's son wouldn't be older than Quarrel... would be.
We know about that.
Meanwhile,
but by the time we get to the 80s, he's like, you know, a mid 50s guy still out there running and gunning. I don't know about that, you know.
Yeah.
And by the time we get to the 90s,
although Moore was already fairly
they should have
old
given him
Bond,
like
so.
Crutches or like a wheelchair that had gadgets and stuff. Just
I want
to going
someday. I think we should make the old Bond movie where it's like
a geriatric
Bond comes out of retirement. The Bond retirement home version. What do we think of the? So you mentioned the hotel receptionist. We have some great Bond girls, Barbara Bach. Is totally hot and a badass and really didn't have any career outside of this. I think her most notable other thing was that
Ringo
she married Sir Richard Starkey, a.k.a. Ringo Starr, a.k.a. the other Beatle.
Yep.
But she was, I thought she was great. I couldn't believe she didn't.
Did they stay married? Do we know that?
For how long? I mean,
that's what I'm asking.
I don't
Are they still married to this day?
Yeah, that's what I want to
know. I don't know.
Nobody knows.
Nobody knows.
Okay.
Nobody knows.
But she's really
clear
provocative. I don't know that she's a really great actress, but she's really good for this part.
She did the part
well. She nails the part. And she has like a charm that's indescribable, I'd say.
She doesn't have a Russian accent until I think there's like one scene where she has a Russian accent. She pulls it out.
Her accent is just like a weird accent.
She kind of has a
like,
Russian accent.
Oh, you just sound vaguely foreign.
What's interesting was when she was trying to get into acting, she got cast in a lot of like Italian movies and stuff like that because she was obviously beautiful. But when she tried out for American parts, apparently she lost some parts because they were like, but can you do an American accent? She's from New York. She's a born and raised American, but there's something about her that made people think that she was foreign. So finally she just sort of, she went overseas and acted in Italian movies. And then in this, she sort of embraced it. So she didn't have to like actually have a convincing American accent.
Yeah. I think they wanted, you know, whatever it is to actually be like Russian in the 70s or whatever, I think what they wanted was a certain like, you know, coldness and like a certain like kind of like an emotional veil. Like you can't always see exactly what she's thinking or feeling, which really comes in handy when it's like, oh, like does she hate Bond? Does she love Bond or whatever?
Right. I think she is still with Ringo Starr. We just looked it up. It says like his first wife was from this date to that, and then it just says her 1981.
Does it have the hyphen that without anything on the other side of it?
Yeah, it just says 1981.
That means they're still doing it.
They're happily married.
They actually go. Congratulations.
I guess nobody does it better.
Nobody does it better. Yeah, they actually, you know what it was? They were co-stars in a movie called Caveman, which was a terrible movie.
Oh, man. And I saw that.
This doesn't sound real to me.
And oh, my God. It is a comedy that's basically like about cavemen.
It's Ringo
similar
Star.
To Encino
and Ringo,
Man with
and Ringo Star stars in it. I would say it's probably better than Encino Man slightly.
You've never seen it? I remember seeing it as a kid. I think there's a part where there's a pterodactyl egg and they crack it open and they cook it.
I believe there is. Like, yes, like a giant egg.
But it's a giant egg. Yeah.
Yes, it's not a great movie, but it has its moments, and it led to a very long-lasting relationship. So
what other girls are in this movie?
What about the one who flies a helicopter?
She's the only Naomi.
Yeah, Naomi, yes, and gets blown up. First woman that Bond kills in a movie.
That's another costume that they really nailed it. When she hops off that boat and she's wearing the bikini with that like thing over it.
And
like
she got real attitude, yeah.
Yeah, like the jacket thing, the thing you wear over a swimsuit or whatever,
right.
It like matches the swimsuit perfectly, and it has all these little danglies of like the colors that color code it to the.
It's really.
We're gonna have to have Colin just do a blog on
the clothing. Yeah.
Give him an erection.
Did you read? You said that she had an attitude.
Yeah.
Did you read why she had an attitude?
No, I didn't. Matt, tell me.
Apparently, she got stung by a bee in the butt, like right before they shot this, right, and they said just use it, and so she was like upset that a bee. Bit her bottom, and now her bottom's big. Yeah.
I would love to see that conversation. I can't go on. I was stung by a bee in the butt.
He's on a mission, sir, in Austria.
Well, tell him to pull out immediately.
Guys, I'm finding soundboards live.
This is what the podcast has been missing.
Right. But now we've broken down. We didn't do the 2-minute plot summary thing.
Oh, yeah. Do you want to try that?
Get on it.
I'm going to go for it.
Okay? I feel like we need a theme song for this next time.
Okay, yeah.
Like a little, like...
Here we go.
It should be the exciting James Bond action.
I can pull it up right now.
Hold on. Let him pull it up.
Okay.
Let's talk about bullshit until then. Oh, you got it?
Go.
All right, so here goes. We start out James Bond. He's in Austria, and they're chasing him. He kills some people. He gets away. He's got to go find these submarines because the submarines are missing. M tells him, you got to find the submarines. We also know that there's a Russian woman. She's looking for a Russian submarine, too. He knows that the plans for a device that could locate the submarines are in Egypt somewhere, so he goes to Egypt. Then he avoids getting killed by a guy, and then he tries to find another guy, and that guy gets killed by Jaws, who's this 7-foot man with iron teeth. He meets the Russian agent, and they, like, you know, hit it off a little bit. They don't full-on fall in love yet, but they're, like, having a banter. They keep chasing after this microfilm. They find the microfilm. Jaws tries to take it. They take it back from Jaws. Jaws try to kill them. Then they discover that in the microfilm, there's evidence that links it to Carl Stromberg. And so they go to Sardinia, they get chased and try to, Stromberg's people try to kill them. Then they go check out Stromberg's place. Oh no, sorry. They check out Stromberg's place, then they try to kill them. Then they decide to go on a submarine with Americans. Then that American submarine gets eaten by Stromberg's big boat that eats submarines, where his lair is. And he also has a lair that's Atlantis. It's an underwater city. And then they have a big showdown in the boat. And then he has to chase him back to the underwater city. And they show down. And then he saves the girl. And then they do it.
Boom. Wow.
Oh, I missed the whole subplot about Bond has killed her lover. So there's a little subplot there where it's like, oh, I've fallen in love with you because, like, we enjoy having sex with each other. Oh, wait, you killed my ex-boyfriend because he's my ex-boyfriend because he's dead. Oh, that makes me mad. I'm going to kill you after this. And then he's like, oh, I don't think you should, but whatever, let's just do it. And then and then in the end, she's like, I still think I should kill you. And he's like, come on, you're not going to do that. And then she's like, no, I'm not going to.
She literally goes from squeezing the trigger that with a gun that's pointed right at his face. And he's like, well, come on.
Yeah, he's
and
then like, come on.
And he pops a champagne cork.
Yeah.
And it's like an awkward moment because there's champagne spilling everywhere. And he just sort of gives her a smile and a shrug. And she's like, I was going to shoot you in the face, but now I think I'll bone you.
You know, I mean, it's simple logic, okay? Like, people live and they die, and in between that, they have sex. You can't have sex with dead people unless you're fucking weird. And so at some point, if someone is dead, you can't have sex with them anymore, and there is a possibility that you will have sex with someone else if you are still alive. Simple logic.
I'm just going to take your word for it, Colin. That was... the summary was great.
Yeah, great job.
Yeah, you did. You had like 15 seconds left, and you snuck in a subplot.
Let's get back to the villains. We kind of mentioned Jaws and Stromberg. Did you guys notice anything physically strange with Stromberg? I feel like there's a subtle thing here that a lot of people don't
notice.
Well,
he has webbed hands, but I never noticed it until I read that.
Yeah, he has webbed hands.
I had to
go
back and look at it when I read
there's
that.
There's one shot where he is looking at Bond, like Bond is arriving in Atlantis, and he looks at him through a monitor, and his hand reaches over to like push a button, and you're not really looking at his hand because you're looking at the monitor to see what Bond is doing. Mm-hmm. But if you look at his hand, you can see the webbed. He has webbed hands,
which
but
is kind of when I didn't notice it. When I thought you should have noticed it, was she's like, oh, by the way, Stromberg doesn't shake hands.
It's so right after that,
and then when Bond goes in there, he tries to shake hands with him, and Stromberg puts his fingertips together like Mr. Burns style in front of his chest. And I couldn't see it then.
Well, because the camera angle is poor. Like, it's, like, dead on, so you can't see him. It should have been, like, from this angle.
And it would have been an interesting point to kind of make a little more clearly, because his whole plan, and we didn't really get into this in the plot summary, but his whole brilliant plan is that he is going to steal these nuclear subs, use them to provoke a war between the superpowers, Russia and the United States, and then destroy the entire world above water in this horrible nuclear apocalypse where the entire world is gone and uninhabitable, and the only place to live will be on his undersea base, Atlantis, because he feels more comfortable being surrounded by fish and guys in red jumpsuits.
Yes. See, that's the thing here. So if you work for Carl Stromberg, you know his plan is to kill everyone in the world except, like, a bunch of guys on a tanker in red jumpsuits and basically no one else.
All
no
guys.
All guys.
It's a real
he did have one woman
fest.
Henchman who he sends on a helicopter to kill Bond.
And she
Bond kills
up.
Her.
Yeah.
But we never see them interact, okay?
And there's no henchman wives quarters there.
Right.
And
he have another female, like a secretary, in the very first scene.
And he kills her
kills
himself.
Her
yes, he kills her. Well, that wasn't her that wasn't his secretary. They make it a point that she was the one who betrayed him.
Right.
And that's why he has to kill her in front of some other guys.
But clearly,
who he then immediately kills.
He
right
kills
after.
Them also.
But he clearly only had a couple of female employees. They did not survive to this new world.
He doesn't even have that many employees.
Right.
If you think about wiping out the Earth's population. And like, we don't see the rest of the underwater city. We only see like the his mansion part of Atlantis.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So he kind of just wants to live alone with fish underwater while everyone is dead.
Yep.
Who signs up for that? And like,
how much would you have to be paid to agree to do that?
And honestly, I think this makes this villain like not as good because like either you think about what he really is doing and you realize this guy's fucking weird, or you like you just take him as like a normal Bond villain, and then you're not thinking about what's happening in the story. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like he didn't think his plan through all the way.
Yeah.
There's a lot of...
Or he did, and he's like...
And this is what he wants. It's just like, I just want a bunch of dudes on an underwater base with a bunch of fish. Is that weird?
I also enjoy the music of the village people.
Harris and I were theorizing about this, what his prior sexual experiences could have been with women, what they could have been with fish, how fish came into it. And we determined that probably his ultimate sexual desire is like a mermaid, but like both bottom halves.
Fish on both ends.
Just so a fish.
Just a woman like a mermaid, but a fish with a fish head and a fish tail.
A human woman with the bottom of a fish and also the top of a fish.
Have you ever seen anything so magnificent, Mr. Bond?
What about this species here, Mr. Bond? That part gets me too. Yeah. So Bond goes to Atlantis to meet Stromberg and like get a feel for this guy, and he's posing as a marine biologist, so you know he's had no time to plan. He just kind of is like, yeah, I'm a marine biologist, my name's Sterling, right? So he goes in there, and Stromberg has this massive like aquarium all around, and there's lots of tropical fish, and he's like, oh, marine biologist, you're a man much like myself. You must, you know, appreciate all these fish. Like this species here, and he points to like some random fish, and he like kind of goes like this, like, well, Mr. Bond, what is it? And Bond looks nervous for a second, but then he pulls it out and he says, like, the Latin name of the fish. How does he know?
He knows.
He knows everything.
He knows everything.
Well, that was in his training. In the Navy, in the British Navy, you have to know all the kinds of fish in case you fall off the boat.
You have to know which ones you can ride to safety. You have to know which ones you can marry if it comes to that.
Which ones you could befriend.
Exactly. It's basic British naval.
No, you're wrong, Mr. Bond. Naval this is training. A fish I've crossbred with a human. This is my
wife. Also, that whole scene, think about it, right? They're looking for nuclear submarines full of enough nukes to nuke, like, 20 cities or something like that. And they're like, our best lead is to go, like, look at this guy's place. They roll up to this fucking mansion of like weird aquatic stuff, and he talks to the guy for 5 minutes, and he's like, I'm a marine biologist, and he's like, oh, I want to build this underwater city, and then Bond is like, oh, well, good luck, and then he leaves.
He's also got like he gets in this, so this is Stromberg's, you know, evil base,
right,
which looks like an evil base because sort of like it looks almost like
it's almost like he's a Bond villain.
It almost looks like a futuristic oil rig where it's like on stilts in the ocean, but the stilts make it look like a giant spider with a face. It's like 80 feet tall.
Doesn't it kind of look like C-Lab from the cartoon?
It does kind of look like C-Lab from the cartoon. And it submerges and it emerges from the water, and he basically somehow by posing as a scientist, he's like, hey, I'd like to tour your evil base, evil shipping genius. Yes, and the guy's like, yeah, come on in for 5 minutes and then leave.
I read that when they were like scouting locations for this movie, there's actually something like this in Japan that they were building. It was like almost complete or almost operational, but it was like this massive sea base kind of like ridiculous $1 billion operation thing. And when they brought Ken Adam there, they were basically like, please shoot here. We need money. And he was like, nah, this isn't going to like...
Didn't it look more like an oil rig and like less like an oil rig?
Yeah.
We're not going to be able to get the shots that we need. And then like that company ended up...
And then they'd already done an oil rig scene before. So,
yeah. I found a live clip of James Bond naming the fish. I'm just going to play it for you guys real quick.
South Central. And I hated it. So I moved to Oahu. Now I can name you over 200 different kinds of fish.
No, you can't.
Oh, yes, I can.
Do it. Yeah, you cannot.
G, ghost piper fish, grill fish, golar fish, grouper fish, greenback.
What's the state fish of Hawaii?
Huma huma nuka nuka apua'a. Yeah, bitch.
That's from one of the later movies, I think.
I looked up the C-Lab concept art of the actual like labs, and it looks like a lot like it.
Yeah, I think they stole this from C-Lab, actually.
It's like a very orb-based design. There's lots of...
Boobs.
Like...
Boobs.
Yes.
This movie, like, really started the cartoonish you know, like elements. Right. I wouldn't there say started.
Were,
they were before.
Quite a bit of cartoonish
but
elements.
But this Stromberg in, guy, like, he's
this one,
so...
like, think about Jaws and think about, yeah, oh, the bass.
Can
and
we talk about Jaws for a second?
Let's talk about Jaws.
Let's talk about Jaws. Jaws is introduced with this... There's two main henchmen in this. One is Jaws and one is Sandor. Let's get Sandor out of the way because that's going to be quick.
Yeah.
Sandor is short and bald and very thick, and Jaws is a giant, like Colin said. No, yeah, he looks like a kind of a little penis.
Yeah.
But
a,
thick.
A chode.
Like girthy. Yeah, he's chode-esque.
He's a human chode.
marry him with the fish species.
And Jaws is giant with metal teeth.
What type of fish is that, Mr. Bond? I believe it's a chode fish.
You can tell by the smell.
He's smelling underwater. Yeah.
You have a keen scent of smell, Mr. Bond.
But so Sandor was played by a former wrestler who's got, honestly, his life story is more interesting than his character story, but we're not going to get into that too much since he really is only on screen for a couple of minutes before Bond kills him very easily, like outfights this enormous thick wrestler and then drops him off a roof. And his last act before getting killed is to rat out his boss.
Yeah.
So he's like a squealer. He's like the worst henchman in every single way.
But it's cool. They have this fight on the rooftop and he kind of pushes him off the building. But before he can fall, he grabs Bond's tie.
Mm-hmm, another great tie.
Yeah, and he's holding – that's a strong tie. He's holding it and he's like dangling off the building. And Bond is like, who's he looking for at that point? Not Stromberg. He's looking for the next guy.
Fekish or something?
Oh, Fekish. And he's like, where's Fekish? Where's Fekish? And
then
he goes,
the pyramids.
Pyramids. And then Bond just goes, whoosh, and hits his tie, and it like slips out of the guy's hand.
Judo chops it?
Yeah, he judo chops it.
I mean, he does a joke then, too, but it's not that great a joke.
Yeah, it's like,
what does he say?
Oh, he was an accommodating fellow or something like that. Yeah, it's something about how he ratted everyone out. But then the other part of this tandem of henchmen is Jaws, and Jaws is introduced very briefly in Stromberg's lair. The next time we see him is at the pyramids where they're doing some kind of crazy light show, and Bond is looking for this guy Fekish, and Triple X and Jaws are also both looking for this guy separately. And we see these like this crazy synth music cue, and these lights come up in the pyramid, and that's the first time we see Jaws like shot from the bottom, all shadowy.
Yeah,
it's like wong.
Cool.
It's a real show.
It's really a badass way to introduce a character too, because he looks totally dope. And then he chases Fekish in, and Fekish tries to get away and locks himself in this cage with a lock with a chain that Jaws bites and bites the chain open. Then he goes and he eats Fekish's neck, which is a little weird and vampire-y.
Yeah.
But he bites his neck open with his giant teeth.
No blood.
You don't see it.
And then Jaws, James Bond is following Fekish, so he ends up seeing Jaws and cornering him, and he's got him at gunpoint, and Jaws has nowhere to run, and then the lights for the show go down for like a half a second, and when they come back up again, he's gone.
Right. This is great. So the cinematography and all the Egypt stuff is all really good. Even that little fight scene with the bald guy, like it has cool like angles and like great location.
Yeah. And Claude Renoir was actually losing his vision at this point, which was he was the guy who shot this thing.
Oh.
But as usual, like great cinematography and amazing. A lot of the Egypt stuff had a lot of location shooting at freaking unreal, great looking like temples that were just so massive and spectacular. But it also always just, even when it's, even like the tent set in Egypt, when they go into the tent, is totally
it's cool.
Has great depth of field. Ken Adams knocking it out of the park as usual. On this.
Well,
some of the best sets in the whole franchise.
The sets at the end with the base, the submarine stuff is like, they're incredible.
Oh, the tanker, I forgot how many gallons of water that thing held, but it was.
And
like
I started thinking, like, how much did this stuff cost? And we were like, how did they have enough money for the budget? And I realized, like, the whole entire first half of this movie in Egypt is all like actual
location stuff.
Right,
they make such great use of them.
But they built the inside of the tanker boat on the inside of a studio, and all that water is in there.
Yeah.
So that cost like $1 million or something like that.
That was at Pinewood.
Which, of course,
was the first time they used
in today's money would be
$1 billion.
Boom.
But anyways, that's just Jaws' introduction. He has so many, like, it's hard to remember any henchman in any movie ever in any franchise having as many great, awesome, like ridiculous moments and scenes. They chase him around a pyramid where Triple X and Bond are chasing him, and then he ends up getting the drop on them and almost kills him there before Bond brings the whole pyramid down on him. I mean, they have another fight in a train, which we saw on From Russia with Love.
Yeah.
I think this is our third great train fight here.
I was going to
say, we had another one Live and Let Die. But this was a great one again.
I was going to say that I feel like Roger Moore was doing more with his like fight scene choreography than he was last movie, even though they did like an Enter the Dragon thing with last movie.
Mm-hmm. And Jaws was such an impressive guy to fight, but it was like they made it look like Bond could hold his own, even though his main move is just
Roger Moore looks a little awkward, like.
Yeah,
several
times. It's just a flying gut kick is his patented move. But
I mean, if you strike with the shin to the middle abdomen in the correct way, I think it is a very violent strike.
Lethal. it will at least
make you like be hunched over for like 10 seconds so that the next move can happen.
This doesn't look so much like a kickboxing strike as like a guy who really
it's like his legs out like this.
It's like, yeah, it's like kind of a flying jump, and then somebody wraps their stomach around his leg. But the coolest thing about Jaws, he doesn't talk at all, but he's basically indestructible. They throw him out of a train. They drop an ancient temple on his head.
He falls in a car full of three other people onto a house. They all die. He lives.
He walks out of the house like dusting himself off.
He's always
off.
Dusting himself off.
And at the end,
scene with him in it, the end is him dusting himself off.
Because somebody like dropped a building on him. Yeah. Yeah. And all he's got is like dust on him.
Yeah.
In the end, Bond actually has him, uses his teeth against him to use a high-powered magnet to attract his teeth, lowers him over a shark tank, and drops him into the hungry shark there.
That's how he wins the train fight, too. He electrocutes him.
Yeah, he electrocutes him. And so he's using his greatest advantage against him. Of course, when he drops him into the shark tank, Jaws immediately grabs the shark
and
eats the shark.
And this is right after Jaws the movie come out, like a year or 2 years before.
And it's a good looking underwater shark fight. I don't really know how they did it, but they made it look pretty convincing. It looked like a giant dude fighting a big shark.
I didn't think about that. I just assumed they really like
just
threw
dropped
him
Richard
Keel in
with a shark. It was just like,
the effects in this movie are great. Even like
Little cheesiness.
The in-camera shots of like the Atlantis and like them approaching it on the boat and like how it goes into it. Like all that stuff looks really good. I mean, now we have the eye to see like how they did it, but it doesn't look cheesy or anything.
Yeah, it's a model.
thank you, Colin.
Oh, thank you. Didn't know.
But so like it's like a smaller thing of the
like,
thing.
I don't know
that
if you guys know how models work.
Is that like an early form of CGI?
Yes.
But yeah, the early form of CGI in this movie was very good. It was so much so that you, like when you noticed, like you were saying before with the skiing close-ups, you noticed it when it was bad because you were, like we've had some hilariously bad special effects in this series. And this one, they did a lot of it practically, and the stuff they blended in with that was really well done. And just the scope of everything was huge. The base, that model base they had looked huge. And you see like cut to Roger Moore looking up at it and you're like, Jesus, that thing's big.
So let me ask you this. So far we're saying the song was great. The opening titles are great. The cold open was great. The costumes are great. The actors are great. The casting is great. The villains are great.
Stromberg's too
weird.
Boobs
are great.
The boobs are great. The effects are great. What didn't we like about this movie? What doesn't work? What is going against it?
I've got a few.
Stromberg and the whole like fish fetish thing. They should have either like put it like out there, or they should have like given him a backstory or something.
Stromberg in general is just another Bond villain with yet another really dumb, lame plan.
But I think the actor who played him did a really good job.
Oh yeah. I think I'd put him somewhere between Telly Savalas on the low end and Donald Pleasance on the high end of my Blofeld ranking, because basically he's just a knockoff Blofeld. So he's somewhere in the middle of my Blofeld.
This is kind of my beef with James Bond, though. Like, he has an eclectic, like, diverse selection of villains, but there's not really, like, even Blofeld. Like, Blofeld is maybe, like, the yin to his yang a little bit.
Right.
But even he's not that great. And we don't have a full grasp of him because he was played by, like, 9 different actors. Mm-hmm. So there's not that, like...
Always doing some different
thing.
There's
no, like, Joker to the Batman. You know what I'm saying? Like,
of course
Bond has all these villains, and they're all pretty, like, different, but vanilla in their own way.
The best
you
can hope for is a great, great henchman. Because that's... And this is one where they sort of leaned into that a little bit, because instead of having his final fight, they usually save the main villain for the end. And this one is... He kills the Stromberg guy pretty easily in yet another lame scene where you're like, Stromberg, what the hell are you thinking? Like... you know, you've got one shot with this spear gun thing under the table.
Why would you warn him?
Yeah, well, and then he warns him, and then basically he's got a gun under the table, and Bond easily avoids that gun and then shoots him the exact same way, I assume in the penis several times, looks like. But they know that that's not their big payoff, because they know that Stromberg is not the biggest threat to Bond, so then they put Bond in a much better battle with Jaws to end the movie, which makes a lot more sense. But this is the best thing. I mean, this is one of the best things about this movie, is they knew that Jaws was a badass villain, and they were like, let's just make him the guy that Bond has to be.
Final fight.
Well, yeah, but that's what I think this movie lacks, because like we look at when we all watch Goldfinger, what stood out for us that really like made the narrative and the pacing work was the Goldfinger character. Yeah, Stromberg doesn't give you that, because it's like, what is going on with this dude? He is freaking weird, and they really gloss over that part. I honestly, if they had just made him like, they're like, oh yeah, it's Carl Stromberg, he's known for having sex with fish. Like, if they'd have just gone and done it, it might have been better.
They could have done a scene where, like, they're like, Bond, have you heard of Stromberg? And he's like, you mean Carl Stromberg?
No, the first thing he'd say is, no, not really. Oh, wait, is he the guy?
Yeah.
And
oh,
then
wait.
Give his entire biography and with any bones, fish, I believe. He's partial to tuna.
But yeah, but like, the story is like, okay, you know, the good part of the story is Bond and the spy who loved him, right? The villain is like so secondary that if you start thinking about it, it doesn't make sense.
Right. No, definitely do not think about the plot in this.
And that's what everything else about this movie is so great. Well, that's what takes away.
Let me run down a short list of the other weaknesses of this movie. It's got a bunch of, not a lot, but it's got a few like stupid cheesy sound effects that they throw in at weird places that I just noticed that were like weird sound effect cues that were kind of dumb.
Like what?
Well, the whooshing of the ski jump thing is the first thing I noticed, but I did notice a couple more. Just like, is there like a? I think there's like a bonk sound effect at one point where somebody gets hit, and they do like a boing. They're leaning into some of the comedy a little hard. That we're seeing what. I mean, we already talked about how there's a lot of lame jokes that don't really land in this movie.
Also the first Bond movie to use music from other movies. Like, they have a gag where they're in the desert and they play the Lawrence of Arabia theme.
And some of those music cues worked, but they did so many of them. They did like five like joke music cues, and only a couple of them
worked.
One
of them was like some Russian thing she had played a chime, and it was like the Dr. Zhivago theme.
Right.
Yeah.
Some of them worked. A lot of them didn't. I also thought the shots of the subs, like that supposed to be this tense moment where there's these two subs that are going to blast each other with nukes, and it took forever. It started reminding me of like some of the other underwater scenes where I'm just like, oh, get it over
with. This also has the problem we've talked about before, where the ending is too long and there's too many endings.
Yeah,
like once the sub eating boat eats them and they're all there together and they're having a showdown basically, then that should be the ending. But Stromberg leaves with the girl and kidnaps her, which, it kind of works, but like it really stretches out the back end of the movie.
You know, I'm gonna argue that in this case, I didn't mind it. That I've complained about that in the past.
Yeah.
They have a massive badass battle in that tanker, but at the same time, you knew Stromberg was gone, so you knew that that wasn't the way the movie was gonna end. You also knew that there were a lot of other things up in the air. I just wish when that battle ends, they have like a scene of them trying to thwart these nukes, which they could have, like, he had to steal the nuke to break into the control room. That scene just took too damn long.
Which,
if they had cut 8 minutes out of that,
it shows how great a set that was,
right?
Because like, okay, so they're in the place and he frees all the semen he frees all the semen from their prison, and they begin to take back over the ship from the red jumpsuits guy.
Should I take over for you?
I got it. And they do, except they can't take the control room because it has like a metal wall, barrier wall. And so he has to go back in, dismantle one of the nukes, take the detonator out, make a new bomb the door, go in, then take it over, then get the submarines to nuke each other instead of New York and Moscow.
And if you, like me, were wishing that Colin could have gotten through that a little faster, you know how it feels to watch those scenes in the movie where they are almost as right. long as what he was just saying.
Right. And the other key thing to remember about that is that there is a lot of grenade throwing, and every single time, mostly, they try to throw Kareem skyhooks with the grenades. Did you notice that?
Yeah, that is how you throw a grenade. I mean, that's it's just that's how they're teaching them in the military. So that's probably
this
what
was 77, right? This was like the height of like Kareem was like just coming onto the scene, right?
Yeah. Well, can I just briefly point out my favorite scene in that entire battle, because they have this huge battle in this massive tanker set. It's the most badass set. There's like a million guys. There's a bunch of guys in red suits, and there's all these guys from the submarines that have been prisoners, the seamen, as Colin. prefers
technical term.
Yeah, it is. And at one point, they're like, "We've got to penetrate this this base that's got this blast shield up
with
and,
the semen."
With the semen, and one of the
made it all over her chest.
It's all over my forearm.
I'm back, bitch.
And one of the guys rushes up. One of these handsome young men, like probably a future James Bond. Rushes up. He's this British kid, and he's like, "Leave it to me, sir." And he grabs a couple of men, and he heads up this plank, and he immediately gets shot like roughly a billion times by every machine gun in the place. It's like his moment of heroism lasts, I think, under 18 seconds.
He calls him out by name instead of like, you, come help me. He's like, Lapkus, like Smith, Johnson.
He's like a great leader.
The British ones.
He's like a great leader. He's brave. He's strong. He's handsome. He's
so
ready
to be
recruited.
These guys are going
to
be important. We know their names. No, and they're dead in 5 seconds.
Oh, yeah.
They die just really fast.
Really fast. Just gets machine gunned all
like,
the hell.
Bond
I thought that
uses
was
a machine gun. Is this the first time he ever, like, annihilates someone with a machine gun?
Oh, yeah. He
movie?
Walks into a room and just, like, he's like, there's 18 guys in there. He's just like.
And, like, people just get, like, riddled with bullets.
Well, there's a lot of red jumpsuits, guys. What was he going to do? He can't karate chop them all.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Judo chop them all.
But those guys are pretty passionate about the future world of them living
under. But why?
They're willing to
die
for that.
This is what I was
going
to say. When they get to the final guy, the guy who's the boss of them, like, the underboss who, like, Stromberg left the nuking to be done by, that guy's just like his whole look once they get in there, he's like, "Why was I even doing this?" And then he dies, you know?
he was like, "I just realized
what does my life come to."
It's like Bond gets him, he's like, "I just realized there weren't gonna be any boobs."
Boobs. Before we get to the very end,
I just
want to
say one more lame thing. Bond at one point rides on like baby's first jet ski.
Oh, that,
it's the dorkiest
looking
me? Jet ski.
That is
Wet
the
Nelly?
Dopest shit I've ever seen. I love that jet ski.
Do you remember Little Nelly? Was that the name of it? The helicopter in like the previous movie?
Yeah.
They called it Little Nelly. This one they called Wet Nelly.
Oh, yeah. No.
Wet Nelly, yeah.
But
free
this has
semen.
My favorite Bond car.
Oh, yeah, the Lotus.
Wait, oh, that's what I was getting to. Yeah. Damn. Yeah, so my favorite sequence in this whole movie is the car, obviously. But in getting
in
to that, it's okay, so this is a stupid thing. Classic like Bond villain thing. He has Bond. He knows who he is. He's right there in front of him. He knows he's lying to him about this marine biologist thing, but he lets him leave, and he then gets Jaws and says, "When they get to the mainland, kill them." Why not just kill them right there? Just kill them. They're
blow
on
up,
your
blow
base.
Up the boat that you just sent them out in. Just
yeah.
put a bomb
you
on
sent
your own
two guys
boat.
Out on a helicopter earlier
I
in the movie and blew them up with the push of
die.
A button.
Oh, good point.
He doesn't what want happened? Them killed in front of the fish.
Yes.
He doesn't want his fishies
I
to see
must
that.
Must not disturb
they
that peaceful life.
By the death of these.
So they get to the mainland. Q gives Bond a car, a Lotus. It's like this white, futuristic-looking concept car kind of thing.
Do you want to talk about how they found this car and how they cast the car in the movie?
You could. Either of us could.
It's a good story, but let me just finish the sequence, and then you can tell that. So he gets the car. We see Q like explain some things to him like from a distance. We don't hear what he says. They get in the car. They drive off. So the first thing that happens is a guy riding a motorcycle with a sidecar is chasing them down. And they both realize they're finishing each other's sentences. She's like, "James, that motorcycle behind us is, and he's, or has, and he's like, been following us for the last mile. Yes, I know." Like, they're trying to show that, like, they're both they're equals, you know. Right. They're she's the James.
Oh, the
Bond.
Driving part was bad too.
Yeah,
when she can't drive and he's like being a total dick about
oh,
it.
Oh yeah,
yeah. That was the only time that they really sort of knocked her down a peg. I think they tried to let her go toe to toe with him for the most part, but then they made fun of the fact that she couldn't drive.
Well,
which apparently was true.
They say that's true, that she didn't know how to drive stick, and all those comments were like he was just really making fun of her.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the sidecar guy pushes a button, and the sidecar is of course a missile. So
awesome.
It like shoots forward. Bond like goes around a truck. The truck gets hit and explodes. It's full of feathers. The motorcycle guy goes through it, and then like the feathers disorient him, and he flies off a cliff and
all
dies.
Those feathers, and he still can't fly.
Yes, great joke.
Which not that one's joke. Not even that funny.
No, it's not.
And also, he was like about 100 feet behind them, and I don't know how they saw the feathers or him dying.
Yeah.
So then you think it's over. Oh wow, we avoided that. Nope. Then a car comes out of nowhere. It's got Jaws and three other guys. They're all shooting out the windows, and I forget how they kind of they stop them.
That's the one that with the car lands inside the house.
Yeah, but how did they get them to fall off the cliff?
Oh shit!
Did he just
don't
shoot
they have
at
a
them,
don't they have?
Oh
they have
no,
like
it's
a,
the cement windshield thing.
Yeah,
the car sprays cement onto their windshield.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, and then they can't see. They fly off a cliff and they go through the roof of like this little Italian like house. And this
which was also corny as hell, and I think had a weird sound effect associated with
it.
Yeah,
and the way it lands is like. Kind of corny.
Yeah, like directly.
Jaws is like Jaws is a cool villain, but he is very cartoonish.
He is the introduction of the really cartoonish James Bond. Like he's the segue into Moonraker.
Well, I don't have a great opinion of Jaws in general, and watching this movie, I was amazed at how badass and awesome and enjoyable he was. And I think my opinion is colored a lot by remembering Moonraker when I think they cheese him up quite a bit.
Yeah.
You only saw little bits of it here. And then they're like, oh, yeah, now we're just going to
I just
lean
wish
the
they
cheese.
Kept him menacing and less corny and then, like, give him the final fight, but give him a cool death at the end. Like,
exactly.
Instead of the magnet thing is brilliant, and instead of dropping him into a shark tank, although, I don't know, the shark tank works because his name is Jaws. It brings it full circle. Like, that's a cool death, using his teeth against him, and then he's eaten by a shark, which is his namesake.
Yeah.
That would have been great.
But I also like him eating the shark and then surviving, much like I like, what's his name, the guy who escaped from on the train at the end of the Baron Samedi.
Oh, yeah.
I like the idea that the villains don't necessarily all have to be killed. We've had him survive before, the henchman. I don't know that I need to ever see him again. I like the idea that he's like this invincible, unkillable monster, but then...
He just like walks into the sunset
But we don't know his backstory.
The
like,
more you see
you
him,
know, like,
the less cool he is, you know?
We don't know that he really loves killing that much. We know he loves...
There is a backstory. Did you read his backstory?
I did read that. But that was written by... That wasn't written by Fleming. It was written by the guy who wrote a novel...
The novelization.
The movie.
I believe it was one of the screenwriters of the screenplay.
But anyway, so the car, they get dispatched, right? So then, oh, wow, we're safe. All of a sudden, no, a helicopter comes out of nowhere. It's shooting at him, right? Who's driving the helicopter? Super hot Naomi. And she's in like a one of these.
Her helicopter negligee.
Her helicopter negligee, exactly. Right? She like smiles and she's winking at him and she's trying to kill him.
She pulls the helicopter up next to him at same speed as if they were two cars driving, but this is a helicopter and a car, and looks over at him, winks at him, and then he makes a face.
So Bond is doing all these tricks. He's spinning around 360, whatever. He's trying to avoid the helicopter. He can't do it, so he's forced to just drive across a dock into the water. And XXX is freaking out. He's like, I hope you can swim or whatever.
That also doesn't make sense, but we can cover that in a second.
What doesn't make sense?
That she's scared. Out.
That's right, because she says something later that doesn't make sense. So he pushes a button, and the car transforms into a submarine. It's the coolest thing.
It's awesome.
It's really, like,
it's very cool.
One of the better parts of this movie.
That's cool.
So, oh, we're safe. We're underwater. Oh, first thing I got to do is push this button and shoot a missile up to blow up the helicopter. He kills her. Now we're safe. Oh, that's it. So they get to his underwater base. All of a sudden, a bunch of guys in scuba gear come out.
And mini subs.
Mini subs.
It's like a mini sub fight. One point, XXX starts running the controls and using some of the gadgets in the thing.
Oh,
and he's like,
a button and a bomb falls.
Yeah, he's like, "What? How did you know that?" And she's like, "Oh, I stole the blueprints for this
2 years
ago." So why was she freaking out when they drove it in the water?
Yeah,
I don't think she really freaks out that much. Like I said, the way she plays a lot of these scenes is like you don't.
We've seen over the top from some Bond girls in the past, and she doesn't do that.
Yeah, she's got a sort of veiled emotion thing going on.
So then to top it all off, Bond kills everyone with the submarine, and it kind of runs out of power, and it kind of falls to the bottom.
So there are guys in scuba gear in that part, right?
Yeah.
So you, that's your favorite part.
What? Because I love scuba.
You do love scuba. You do.
I want to try to make you that part
scuba,
of the podcast.
Callum loves semen. That's everyone's favorite part.
And Chris loves
boobs.
It's got it all.
It's got it all. So the car, the sub turns back into a car and it rolls up onto a populated beach. Everybody's looking. They're like, oh my God, what is this car? And the window rolls down and Bond drops a fish, which makes no sense.
How well, there were holes in the submarine and water was coming in.
Bullet holes.
Not, bullet holes.
Not fish size holes.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
But that's a great scene because they that roll up onto sequence. A crowded beach with tourists everywhere.
Yeah. I just had for that, I just wrote down motorcycle dash sidecar dash land dash torpedo exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point. That was my take on that.
I mean, it's a great sequence, but it's ultimately a pointless sequence because Stromberg could have just killed him.
Stromberg should have
killed him. He literally let them go just so they could have that chase sequence.
Also, that car is so cool. I mean,
the whole movie is kind of dumb if you think about it too much. So let's just get to the point where we talk. You know what else was great about this, though? Another great Jaws moment. When she opens the closet on the train, I legitimately was like, holy shit, that was scary.
That was scary. That was good.
I jumped. Yeah.
All right, we got to get to the end where we're running out of time here.
I'm ready.
The final bit, we actually kind of talked about it already. He kills Stromberg, this, like...
Well, he's got Agent Triple X tied up on a chair, and then he's sitting there like watching her tied up on a chair. But it doesn't look like he's like into it.
Stromberg was not sexually aroused in any way.
It's almost like he desired something else.
If only she had the head of a fish and the tail of a fish,
and the vagina of a fish.
But he does put her in like a sexy outfit, like a red.
Yeah,
like, he's trying to work it up.
Which is another great costume. Another
he's
great
like, no, costume. Nothing. Still pushing rope.
They should have had him
can
looking.
You make any fish noises?
No. Oh well. Time for me to masturbate with my fish hands.
Turn the lights out. Maybe
once again.
They should have had him looking for the sexy outfit and like feeling the material and like none of them being scaly enough.
Just opening cans of tuna. And just
So after he frees Triple X, kills Stromberg, he shoots him in the nuts. I assume.
Oh, with the jet ski though. The jet skis. Awesome.
With the jet ski.
Why is that jet ski lame? That's the beginning of jet skis.
No, because the jet skis like, became a thing. You receive the package from Q, and then they bring in a thing. Like,
but also,
Q just knows what he
needs
like, all the time.
It's like tiny, and it's got like little decals on the side that are like awesome. Colorful. And it's like, it doesn't look like a badass, cool spy jet ski. It looks like a tiny, mini, like something that wouldn't go that fast and would be kind of lame.
I want one.
But he drops Jaws into the Jaws tank, and then the base they're on, the his sub friends had orders to blow the thing up, so they blow the thing up. So as usual, it blows up. It floods, and he and Triple X have to escape, and they somehow manage to get into an escape pod. And then,
escape pod. Why is the escape pod just a bed? Why is the champagne chilled?
Nice. Yeah. Well, because
in anticipation.
It was supposed to be full of fish, and that was going to be Stromberg's escape pod when he got out. It was just supposed to be fish and champagne.
Well, it does have those kind of windows. Like, yes, maybe exactly. It was just like, I'm going to escape and be Hold down on. Here with the fish.
I found the note I was looking for. It says, the film introduced to the world a spy sea scooter known as a wet bike, better known now as a jet ski, sparking a new water activity industry.
See, the jet skis are a thing because of it.
Yeah.
And that's they how all, and every was. Jet ski since then looks cooler than that one.
But yo, wet bike is a cool word. Like, if I was like, yo, do you want to come to the beach? We're going to ride wet bikes.
You want
to
come hop on my wet bike?
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah, I would pass. I would pass. Absent more information, just based on the name, I would probably go ahead and.
But amongst the crew, they didn't have a name for it at that point, so they just called it the motorbike that rides on water.
Which sounds like an Asian, like an American translation of like an Asian name.
See, man who has sex with fish.
You call it the Sun Ping. It's motorbike that rides on water. So anyways, Triple X is going to shoot him at the end. For some reason, inexplicably, he gives her that look, and she decides not to. And then they get it on, and she's like, what would our superiors say if they found out? And he says, they'll never know. And of course,
they immediately
get picked
show
up
on a big boat.
Open it up, and the British M says, 007, and the Russian guy says, Triple X.
Yeah.
And he goes, what are you doing? And Bond says, Just keeping the British end up, sir.
Oh yeah, that's a good one.
Another innuendo.
Innuendo.
And that's the end of.
To me, that one's funnier than the other ones.
The Spy Who Loved Me.
Keeping the British end up.
So are we at our?
It's British.
Yeah. There. Well, the last thing is, it says Bond will return in For Your Eyes Only.
Oh wait,
which is not true.
The Russian guy is a recurring character. He's going to come back. He's pretty good.
Triple X's boss,
Gogol.
He's like General the Russian Gogol. M.
Yeah. Yeah, and he comes back for five movies.
Though. Last thing, they say M's name in this one.
And Q's. Mm-hmm.
And Q. Yeah, yeah, that was interesting.
It was. Okay, now back to the fact that they did the movies out of order.
Yeah, so they say the next Bond will be back in For Your Eyes Only, but then in the time that this between when this movie came out and the next one, a little movie called Star Wars came out.
I've never heard of that. What's that about?
It apparently did really
well.
Did
that have some of those like pre-computer graphics? Early
CGI.
I have a question for Matt, because Matt talked about how he thinks each of the Roger Moore movies are a response to what's popular in cinema at the time. So what is this one, besides Jaws? Because I think that's like just a reference.
Well, and this was in production before Jaws had come out
right, and
been a huge hit, too.
So they actually wanted Spielberg. He was like one of the candidates to direct this movie,
but
he couldn't for whatever reason. He was making Close Encounters.
I think they decided that... I heard is they decided he was untested, and he had just made this movie that had all these problems that went way over budget, and then of course that came out and was Jaws and was a huge hit.
Yeah.
And
so. You know, I was thinking about this earlier, and this is the movie I struggle with the most. But there is something here. There is some like zeitgeist 70s thing that's going on here, and I think it's something having to do with that cartoonish like element that I was talking about earlier.
Oh.
And I'm trying to think of other movies from.
I thought it was gonna be like you were gonna say like. Because this actually has like an actual strong female character now, it was a response to some movie like that or something.
Yeah, well, also in the 70s, they had a lot of like love story and like love kind of like romantic comedy.
The
not
genesis
even comedy,
of
just
like romantic
movies were popular.
Yeah,
and I think just the title alone kind of like speaks to those moviegoers.
I think, like I said, that their part of the plot is the strong part of the plot.
Mm-hmm.
Like. The Stromberg thing is just like, what the hell's going on here with this fish man? But them having first falling for each other, which is like, I mean, it's not very complicated in these James Bond movies. He seems to have some sort of thing that makes women want to have sex with him. But
his penis.
Yeah. Yes. Oh. His large, large member.
I see. But then, you know, she finds out he's the one who killed her ex-lover, and she's really mad about that. And that's a scene. That's just like a good, like, five-minute one-on-one scene where they talk about it, and you see them both reacting to each other and all that stuff. And then the story continues. You continue to see them interact, and, like, you know, they save each other's lives and all this stuff. And then, of course, in the end, she decides not to kill him because she... you know, is the spy who loved him or whatever. And, like, that's the strong plot there. Not so much, like, there's a weird
like
fish man with a
nuke
plan. That
speaks to how good this movie is, because I feel like in a lesser Bond movie, you'd be bored at a scene like that, and you'd be like, okay, just get to the part where stuff blows up, you know? But I think you're right. Those scenes are strong in this movie, and it's interesting.
And all her costumes are good? In the scene where she finds out he killed her lover, she's wearing this, like, drapey, flowy thing that's, like, quite nice.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it a frills or furls?
It's flows.
Are you saddened by the lack of Moneypenny in this movie?
Well, she is in there.
Right.
She did have a good appearance where basically her office is now
in
some pyramid.
Yeah, that becomes a gag. But she's in about, what, two scenes or one scene?
Only shot from a distance.
Though. Only shot from a distance, that's right.
Take it easy.
She has no close-ups in this movie.
Well, you know.
That could be a Bond title.
Only shot from a distance.
That's
only
really cool.
Only shot from a distance.
Let's do the song.
Yeah, nice.
We should do that for an episode.
Only
make our own Bond song.
Only shot from a distance.
Try to sing like Shirley Bassey.
Only shot from afar.
Never shot from close up. Because that's too damn close.
Oh my God, write it down. Somebody write this down.
Only shot from a distance. Oh my God, that's great. I forget what we were saying.
I think we're just at the end.
We're
right?
Gonna get to a 00 scale.
Let's do it. Yeah. Theme song. We need a theme song here.
Yeah, got you.
I'm not saying
for now, but like for eventually we need to have like a little.
We'll just do the regular Bond.
Well, so who's?
All right.
Okay, who's first?
I think I went first last time. So Harris, you want to take it away?
I wanted to go last because I wanted to measure my score based on what you overraters always do, because I'm the voice of reason in this group. I'm the one who makes sure that we don't rate everything a 9.5 or whatever by having sort of realistic ratings.
Did you say you're a regulator?
Yeah. Mount up.
You can go first then.
It's an eight. He's going to give it a 10.5.
There's no money penny.
He gives shitty ones nines.
It's an eight.
I don't have the. I forget like what we ranked.
There's not enough
the
money
ones.
Penny, and Stromberg's a weird fish man, and Jaws is. And there's too much cartoony stuff, but it's a really strong, really good Bond movie. I could probably rate it higher, but. I like Live and Let Die a little better. So to me, Live and Let Die is a 9. This one's an 8. It's a really strong 8. I'd say it's an 8, almost a 9.
I was going to give it an 8 also. I mean, I'm torn. I almost want to give it a 9. But despite it having a lot of things that I love about Bond movies, and I really think it's well made and like it's got a lot going for it, it's hard for me to give it that close to a 10 because... It's strange. Like, all the elements are there, but maybe it's the test of time or something. Like,
also, the ending is the whole third act is like really stretched out by that having like multiple endings.
Yeah, it did feel a bit long, the whole movie even. But there's just, I don't know, there's a lot going on. I mean, I know we're not giving halves, so for that, I have to step back to an 8.
Well, this is good because you guys both gave it an 8. I can give it what I originally planned on giving it and what I wrote down, which is a 9.
What?
Because I think this is really great. It's a little dated, it's a little corny, and Moore is never going to top Connery. But that having been said, start to finish, this was top notch. Like, this is what a Bond movie should be. It had all the elements. I enjoyed the hell out of this. And it was, I just felt like it checked every box for me so I could overlook the many valid flaws that you guys point out. And give it, this is, I never even rated any of the Connery movies a 9. This is the highest rating I've given something. But when I was looking back on it, I was like, it's just got everything, and it does everything really well. So I could nitpick, but I'm solid 9. I feel like we're giving it a pretty accurate score here.
It does have my favorite car. I really like that car. Turning into a submarine.
Maybe I'm going to change mine again. I changed it at the last second. It's got to be a 9. I wanted to give it a 9 originally. I didn't because I thought
it's
going to
be
our
highest rated thing by far at this point, because we've never given something a score this high.
I mean, so. I would argue that this is my favorite one thus far.
Yeah, well, clearly it's mine, so.
It's really good, man. Yeah, I mean, like, good. Live and
I
mean, Let
I
Die
give,
is
I
really
give most
good,
things
too.
That I like a 6, so this is kind of a departure for me.
This is fun. It's a fun movie.
It is a fun one. That's it the might, bottom line, is I enjoyed the hell out of it.
I mean, to me, it might be one of, the, like, maybe the best one that I've seen, but to me, I like Live and Let Die better, and so
I
can't
really
rate
like
it
Live
as
and
high.
Live and Let Die too.
But it's, like, it's a little subjective, though. It's, like, kind of like, it just, it appeals to me.
So I guess not much question here. License to Watch.
Definitely. And I officially changed my vote to a 9.
All right.
Okay. So yeah, License to Watch for sure.
License to Watch issued.
One of the best.
All right.
Would you like to do the
honors? Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to do this part too then.
Because you're so good at reading.
You're good at reading.
I can do it. I look at the paper and I see that there are shapes on it, and those shapes are letters.
The more you explain it, the more it takes the magic out of it. Right.
So that's our show. Thanks for listening. If you like the show, please rate us on iTunes and give us a shout out on social media. Or hit up our inbox at bondcastjamesbondcast@gmail.com. Please subscribe. Get your friends to subscribe and help us spread the word of Bond.
Bond will return in For Your Eyes Only.
No.
Moonraker. Oh, and we have one last thing. Taking us out.
Oh, yeah. Taking us out. We have a special guest.
Submitter.
Guest submission from a fan. We have fans.
Yeah.
And
what's Tim's SoundCloud handle?
SoundCloud
again? Tim Got Rhymes.
Tim Got Rhymes. SoundCloud. Tim Got Rhymes.
Is that spelled any special way?
TimGotRhymes.
So the usual way.
Special guest song.
So it's another remix of Nobody Does It Better by a special guest. Yeah. Baby.
Russian thing. Let's get on with these wet things.
James, what would our superior say?
Double X.
Vaughn, what do you think you're doing?
Your time's running out, Stromberg.
Yours too, Mr. Vaughn. And faster than you think.
You shot your bow, Stromberg. Now it's my turn.
Maybe I misjudged Stromberg. Any man who drinks Dom Perignon 52 can't be all bad.